So I want to say just a word about that Ecclesiastes reading to Mary Gray's point. This is not a sermon particularly focused on that text, and especially the more familiar parts of that text, but I do want to just acknowledge, especially right when you get to the end, right? There's a time for love, and there's a time for hate. There's a time for peace, and a time for war, right? And so when we're living in the context, and this is true of human experience and human history, right? As we know, going all the way back to the beginning, when we're surrounded by conflict and war and expressions of hatred, it's difficult to hear a text like that and hear that maybe there's some preordination or there's some fatalism or there's some divine order that leaves room for hatred and war in the context of our lives. But what I would suggest to you is that a text like that, this is from the Hebrew wisdom literature, in my view speaks, you know, the text where Jesus says, the poor you will have with you always. To me, these kinds of texts speak to the reality of human experience, the reality of human history, our capacity both to love, right? To love, and our capacity to hate, our capacity to make peace with each other, to live in peace with each other, and our capacity to make war, as we know and see all around us in Ukraine and in many places around the world, even as we gather this morning. So I want to suggest to you that texts like Ecclesiastes name the reality that we've all experienced, but in the context of a larger arc, right? The moral arc of the universe that Dr. King described that always leans toward justice and love and reminds us of our call to pray, to continue to pray for peace, to work for peace and justice, to bring love, God's love into the world, even in the midst of that reality. So I say that as sort of a mini reflection on what can be a very difficult text to hear, especially in context. But on to the sermon at hand. As most of you know, Amy, Gabe, and I were away last weekend for a family reunion near Boston, a gathering prompted by the death of my uncle, Jerry Reardon, back in November after a long struggle with Parkinson's disease. His funeral was held in January, but because of COVID concerns at the time, only immediate family were allowed to attend the service in person. And so Plan B sprouted, a summer reunion in his memory. As some of you know, my Uncle Jerry, my dad's oldest brother, was the reason I moved from Baltimore to Philadelphia 26 years ago, almost to the day, after wrapping up a couple of years as an AmeriCorps volunteer in Baltimore, with no idea where my life was going, no sense of direction. He, along with my Aunt Sue, had been in Philly, living in Philly since the early 1960s, raising their three sons here before eventually retiring to Massachusetts in 2007. They set me up with my first apartment, a third floor rental at the home of their longtime friends in East Falls. My aunt and uncle opened a lot of doors for me over the years. Uncle Jay, as I came to call him, was the United Methodist pastor, serving for a time in West Oak Lane, and for many years part of the staff at First United Methodist Church of Germantown, what many of us know affectionately as FUMCOG, before focusing his career as a pastoral counselor. This was the uncle who baptized me when I was 11 during another family reunion in Ohio. This was the uncle I never really knew until he invited me to join him on weekly trips down to Washington, D.C. when I was in Baltimore, he in Philly, for a class he was teaching on community at the renowned Church of the Savior. He would drive from Philly and pick me up in Baltimore on the way, and we had those couple of hours every week to talk and get to know each other. This was the uncle who helped me through my darkest years in Philadelphia, when I first struggled with depression, This was the uncle who connected me with my first therapist, something I was very resistant to at the time, who turned out to be a godsend for my 20 and 30 something year old self. This was the uncle who married me and Amy right in this spot where I'm standing now. This was the uncle whose death was recognized at this year's clergy session of our annual conference in Eastern Pennsylvania, his final clergy session, as it were, was my first. I miss him dearly. His obituary named two of his family's favorite Jerry-isms. The first was, take your anxieties and nudge them toward curiosity. And the second was, the universe knows how to take care of you. It was also noted in the obituary that he was well known and widely beloved as someone who was able to turn a maze into a labyrinth. A maze into a labyrinth. He did that for many, many people, including me, including Amy, turning mazes into labyrinths. You are likely familiar with labyrinths, ancient archetypes dating back at least 4,000 years, featuring a singular meandering path leading to and from a distinct center. That's the image you find on your bulletin, Eric. You're welcome to scroll back to that if folks want to take a look. We used to have a monthly gathering pre-pandemic with our own labyrinth in this space. I hope that we can get back to that at some point. But labyrinths used symbolically for walking meditation, for ritual and ceremony, used to represent spiritual pilgrimage, life's journey, a tool for personal, psychological, and spiritual transformation and reorientation. Labyrinths serve to open up a deeper sense of groundedness, a clearer sense of direction, finding and reconnecting to your spiritual center, even when the path you're on feels all over the place, even when the path itself feels like a maze. In a maze, of course, you can easily lose your way. In fact, you're meant to. In a labyrinth, you're meant to find it. In a maze, you can feel hopelessly lost, disoriented, distracted, afraid. In a labyrinth, you can feel hope fully found, balanced, focused, confident, trusting that the path you're on, the divine path you're on, will eventually lead you to the center and then back out again from that center. That is the spiritual journey to which we are all called. Labyrinths and my Uncle Jerry were very much on my mind this week in reading and hearing again the story of the two sisters, Martha and Mary, as Mary Gray also just read for us. It's a short story, if ever there was one, only 4 verses long, but it is long on wisdom. If you were here a few months ago, you may recall that we encountered another story about Martha and Mary, found only in John's gospel, presumably the same Martha and Mary, though there's no way to know for sure. That story followed Jesus's miraculous raising of Martha and Mary's brother Lazarus from the dead. They threw Jesus a dinner party to celebrate, and while Martha served, Mary took costly perfume and anointed Jesus's feet, a profound, open-hearted, open-handed act both of hospitality and devotion. And right, and that's the story that prompted this expression from Jesus that the poor you will have with you always, as he celebrated Mary's act of hospitality and devotion. And so that act included its own controversy. There is some resonance in this story of the two sisters. Here, Martha and Mary are presented in sharp contrast upon Jesus's arrival at their home. Martha is specifically named as the one who welcomes him, but then gets distracted by her many tasks. Meantime, Mary, apparently, doesn't lift a finger to help. She simply and promptly sits at Jesus' feet so she can listen closely to what he has to say. It's easy to put ourselves in Martha's shoes. We can relate to Martha, most of us. We can picture her up early having heard that Jesus and the 12 were headed their way. We can picture perhaps her up late the night before, up again early that morning, cleaning the house, readying up, as my mother-in-law likes to say, a Western Pennsylvania expression. I know that's what we do when companies come into town. You know what I'm talking about. The house always looks way, way better when we have guests than it ever looks like when we're there by ourselves. Maybe Mary's out with friends or lost in a book or sleeping while Martha does all the work, all the preparation. We can easily imagine Martha's blood starting to boil. We can relate to Martha, most of us. Then Jesus arrives, but there's still so much to do to get the meal ready. Martha greets him at the door and returns to the kitchen to check the fire, to pour the tea. And she sees Mary, for God's sake, just sitting down with Jesus. Are you serious right now? Are you serious? As far as we know, Martha doesn't even ask Mary to help. As far as we know, she just lets her resentment build inside her. We can relate to Martha, most of us. Her resentment builds before she finally goes, not to Mary, but to Jesus, to speak her peace. Lord, do you not care? Do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? How carefully worded this question. That, you'll recognize, is a loaded question. It comes with serious baggage. You know a loaded question when you hear one. You know a loaded question when you ask one. A question, of course, that Martha's already answered for herself. Clearly, Jesus, you don't care about me any more than my sister does. It is a question as pitiable and passive aggressive. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, right? Ways that we get in our own way. It's as pitiable and passive aggressive as not talking to Mary directly in the first place. You claim, she says to Jesus effectively, to be so loving and compassionate, but you clearly don't care about me. She goes on boldly insisting that Jesus tell Mary to help her. This you'll recognize as another ploy. As a textbook triangulation, attempting to have Jesus speak her peace for her, to pull Jesus into her growing conflict with her sister. No mention, by the way, of Lazarus, if this is the same Martha and Mary as that story from John. Gender norms being what they were, he would not have been expected, of course, to do anything but sit with Jesus himself. And we could understand if Martha was resentful of him too. Gender norms be damned. In any case, Jesus, to his credit, refuses to get pulled into the triangle. Martha is how he starts off. Maybe he's shaking his head and rolling his eyes, Martha, as he does that, but I don't think so. His response is more compassionate than that. Martha, I see you, I hear you. You are worried and distracted by many things. There is need of only one thing. I see you, Martha, I hear you. In this moment, you're in a maze. I hope you'll take your apron off and join me and your sister and the others so we can see and hear each other in the labyrinth. He says, Mary has chosen the better part, which will not be taken away from her. You have your own choice to make, Martha, but don't take Mary's away from her. Mary, in this moment, has chosen to express her hospitality, her devotion, by sitting at Jesus' feet, being as fully present and attentive to him as she can be. And Jesus affirms her calling and her clarity. And note here that he also affirms her blatant violation of existing gender norms and boundaries, sitting to study as a student, a disciple with men at the feet of her rabbi. Martha often gets a bad rap in this story. Theologians have been arguing its point for centuries. The story ends there with Mary's better part that will not be taken away from her. So we don't know. We don't know how Martha responds. But that's the beauty of a good story, right? A good parable. We are left to wrestle with the lessons ourselves. And like I said before, this story is packed full of lessons if we're willing to listen. We could easily imagine Martha storming back to the kitchen after her exchange with Jesus, her tail between her legs, banging pots and pans, right? So everyone can hear how hard she is still working in the kitchen by herself. Her frustration and irritation only increasing now with Jesus and Mary. But that presumption draws an unnecessary line between Mary and Martha and limits the lessons to be learned from this story. Martha's example, a clear repudiation of busyness, of distraction, of overwork, overfunctioning, of life in a maze. And Mary's, on the other hand, a clear endorsement of slowing down, of listening, of focusing, of being fully present to the moment at hand, life in a labyrinth. But remember that Jesus tells Martha that Mary has chosen the better part in this instance, which acknowledges that there are other parts, important parts that make up the whole. It takes all parts and it takes all kinds along life's way, to be sure. Jesus does not choose sides here. He doesn't throw Martha under the bus, but he does highlight the necessary balance, the interdependence of work and rest, of action and contemplation, the balance and interdependence at work in creation from the very beginning. We're not called to be Mary above Martha. We're called to be both. We are both. There is capacity for both in all of us, each of us. Jesus points to the kind of self-awareness, the kind of faithful spiritual seeking that moves us ever closer to the one thing, in touch with the better part, that moves our lives into greater alignment with and deeper grounding in the things that really matter, that matter most at any given point, that call our attention to the present moment, apart from the dogged distractions of what has been or anxieties about what will yet be. For everything, there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven. Again, this Ecclesiastes text is a familiar one, even in popular culture, and it offers some helpful perspective. But I found myself drawn instead this week, in light of this story about Martha and Mary, to the less familiar verses that follow. What gain have the workers from their toil? I have seen the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. God has made everything suitable to its time. Moreover, and hear this especially, moreover, God has put a sense of past and future into their minds, yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. We are blessed and we are cursed with the ability to hold both the past and the future in our minds. And we spend much of our lives, too much of our time, if we're being honest, distracted by one or both. So often, speaking at least for myself, stuck in the maze, unable to find our center in the present moment, the present opportunity, the present company right in front of us, in the midst of all the distractions, in the midst of even our necessary labor. These verses from Ecclesiastes offer divine perspective. We are blessed and cursed with a sense of past and future in our minds, but are reminded here, and we need to be reminded again and again, that past and future extend far beyond our own lives, far beyond our own blips on the radar. Within that long divine arc, there is a continuous invitation for all of us to move from the maze to the labyrinth. Slow down, to listen, to resist the pull of the many things, including many things past and future that call our attention, that so easily steal the attention of our hearts and minds and bodies, and instead focus our attention on the one thing, on what really matters, to seek and find and connect to our divine center, the better part, suitable to its time, as Ecclesiastes puts it, trusting that it will not be taken away from us when we do. There are so many lessons to be drawn from this story of Martha and Mary. I leave you to that wrestling on your own, but let me close now with a poetic take from Jeff Schrouder, a retired pastor from Australia. Busy, distracted, Martha saw no time to be centered, attentive. Despite the demands, it helps when things get busy to take 3 deep breaths. Set one's heart on this, to be centered, attentive, Mary's better part. May it be so.